And in 2 weeks, we'll look at some of the current efforts of our denomination to confront racism and challenge white privilege, and they are many. But first, more of our history. Reverend Egbert Ethelred Brown was our first black ordained Unitarian minister. Brown was born in Jamaica in 1875. His family was active in his local church, but in his late teens, after reading a copy of Channing's sermon defining Christian Unitarianism, Brown realized he no longer believed in the Trinity. In his early 30s, he actually felt called to Unitarian ministry, but there were no Unitarians in Jamaica. So he sent a letter addressed to any Unitarian minister in New York City, and someone actually received it and replied, talking about the Unitarians in Meadville Seminary in Pennsylvania. I don't think that would happen now, but it happened back then. Brown wrote to Meadville Seminary to ask about a correspondence course. The president of Meadville wrote back, there was no such course. Brown would need to come to America. Brown later wrote that the Meadville president told him, as there was no Unitarian church in America for colored people, he was unable to predict what my future would be at the conclusion of my training. It took 3 years, but finally Brown did come to America to attend Meadville. The president at Meadville eventually became a staunch supporter of Brown. But things were different at the American Unitarian Association. Most of you are aware that there were Unitarians and Universalists, and they combined in the early 1960s. So we're talking now about the American Unitarian Association, not the Unitarian Universalist Association. Too similar. In 1912, Brown was ordained, and he was told by the AUA, the American Unitarian Association, that they would provide funds to assist his ministry in Jamaica. However, the AUA pictured a humanitarian mission, not a church, and in Kingston, not in Brown's own Montego Bay. So Brown moved to Kingston, and he started a church, to the AUA's consternation. By 1914, all funds had been cut off. A representative from the AUA visited and sent a report back on Brown's work. The Reverend E.E. Brown is pronouncedly black, he wrote, which is somewhat of a handicap to him in his work, since those of his race who are fortunate enough to approach absolute whiteness are too proud to sit under any minister, say a white gentleman. This is our history, folks. Brown went to Boston to ask for financial help, and funds were restored, but only for a few years. Debts mounted. Finally, in frustration in 1920, Brown and his family moved to New York, where he started a small church in Harlem. The AUA viewed these efforts with skepticism, too. Brown's church was in a storefront, very different from the large stone and brick churches that the AUA was used to. Furthermore, Brown had just gone ahead and started his church. He hadn't taken any surveys. He hadn't done any demographic analysis. He just established a church. Brown became a respected community member in Harlem. But his church floundered, often underfunded and unsupported. Brown continued to be contentious and impulsive and do things in his own way, and the AUA continued to be traditional and frustrated with him. Brown died in 1956, and his church no longer exists. No further efforts were ever made in Jamaica or in Harlem. This actually isn't in my sermon, but I'm going to tell you anyway. In 1860, there was a black man who was a Baptist minister. It was then, and still is, very common for people in other denominations to slowly become Unitarian ministers. William Jackson, his name was, had broken off from a Baptist church that he worked with and started a new congregation, which was much more liberal. And he actually went to the annual meeting of the Unitarian Association and basically said, I am a Unitarian at heart. Could you please grant me fellowship in your denomination? I would love to bring my congregation with me. They listened to him. The theme speakers earlier in that convention had all been about how we need to spread Unitarianism. We need to find ways to take it to the West. We need to take it to different classes. That had been the theme of the whole thing. But when the Black Baptist minister stood up and said, I would like to be fellowshipped in your faith and bring a congregation with me, there was beyond no support for him. He was given something like $70 and sent on his way. We have lost some important opportunities. Between 1889 and 1993, only 23 people of color were ordained in our denominations, both of them combined. Currently, out of over 1,500 active clergy, under 100 are people of color. This is not surprising. Our membership is overwhelmingly white. In almost all of our churches, that's true. However, the percentage of African Americans among our membership, which was never large, is actually lower now than it was 60 years ago. The reasons for this drop are complex, and we'll examine one of the main reasons this morning. In examining this part of our history, what's come to be called the Black Empowerment Controversy, we'll encounter a host of acronyms, which I've defined on this whiteboard. And my hope is that at the end of this, if you hear people refer to some of these things, you'll have some idea of what they're talking about, because it's coming up a lot, especially in light of our current efforts to address this. In a nutshell, our denomination, like the rest of our country, was rocked by the Black Power movement in the late 1960s and early 70s. And especially in hindsight, we came up short. Our former UUA president, the Reverend Bill Sinkford, elected in 2001 as the first Black president of a mainstream majority white denomination, wrote, following the Black Power controversy, Unitarian Universalism went into a period of steep decline. The controversy was clearly not the only reason, but it was one of the most important. Dealing with race and dealing with conflicts became threatening to us, and Unitarian Universalism became afraid. The declines in membership and stewardship are easy to document. Harder to document is the spiritual toll that the silences and withdrawal took on our beloved faith. Unitarian Universalist innocence proved to be an illusion, and our optimism an empty promise on both sides of the racial divide. After the agony and engagement of the late 1960s, Unitarian Universalism retreated for almost two decades of silence about race. It was not until the mid-1980s that race was again the subject of a GA resolution. I would add to his comments that our numbers actually had increased some in the last couple of years, finally. So what was it that caused so much pain and spawned such silence? In the 1960s, our country experienced social upheaval around many issues, and one of the major ones was race. Voting rights in the South, the Civil Rights Act, the riots of 1967 in so many cities, the rise of Black Power, and the murders of Medgar Evers and Emmett Till, Jimmie Lee Jackson, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X, and so many others. There were arrests and marches, dogs and water hoses and billy clubs, desegregation of schools and colleges with the National Guard standing by for protection, sit-ins at lunch counters, and we've all seen the images. These were very, very difficult times for our country and for our faith. The first organized UU response to all of this happened in the mid-1960s in Los Angeles, where a group called the Black Unitarians for Radical Reform, or BUR, arose, quickly followed by a group of white supporters of BUR, or SOBER. I love the acronyms. In October of 1967, the UUA board organized a conference to bring together by invitation approximately 125 laymen and ministers to analyze the riots of the summer of 1967 and to plan how Unitarian Universalists, locally and denominationally, can help to give a new level of commitment to Black Americans and to the cities by setting new local and denominational priorities. Shortly after the conference began, a Black UU Caucus, which came to be known as BUC, Black UU Caucus, and you'll hear about that a lot, was formed by people within the conference. And BUC presented a list of demands. Black representation on the UUA board, executive staff, and finance committees, subsidies for the training of Black ministers, efforts by our publishing house, Beacon Press, to seek out black authors, and most importantly, the establishment of a UUA-funded organization which was to be known as the Black Affairs Council, or BAC. Their proposal was that this organization was to be funded by the UUA for $250,000 a year for 4 years, with the funds solely administered by BAC. The conference agreed to support the demands that Buck presented, though not unanimously. Now, caucuses or similar groups to attend to the needs of subgroups within our UU membership are not new. We have a humanist fellowship, a Christian fellowship, a women's federation. There have been dozens of such organizations at various points. But this particular one, Buck and Back, raised a new level of support and fear, controversy, and conflict. BAC, as originally proposed, would categorically exclude some people, namely whites. Some felt that Buck and BAC violated our primary principles. Others thought that such groups were living them out. Some believed that funding BAC was a gesture of good faith, demonstrating real trust in the experiences and priorities of blacks. Others felt that organizations based on race or around issues of race were destructive and exclusionary, and so they opposed any funding at all. There seems to have been little recognition or discussion of the history of white-only policies, including the reality, and it is a reality, of race-based membership restrictions or practices in many of our own churches. The issue was simply the challenge of black-only organizations and entities. The next month, in November 1967, the UUA board took up the conference's proposal. The board refused to completely endorse or completely reject the demands of the conference, although it reaffirmed its commitment to an integrated society, and it urged the conference's steering committee to assist with the churches and fellowships. Buck, the Black UU caucus, asked for affiliate status in the UUA. The UUA president said that funds could not be given along purely racial lines. The only specific action of the board was to expand black representation on its Commission on Race and Religion. The members of the conference steering committee and Buck and BAC were left feeling rebuffed and ignored and betrayed. In February of 1968, the first national conference of the Black UU Caucus, or BAC, was held in Chicago, funded by the UUA. Its recommendations? To replace the UUA's Commission on Race and Religion with BAC, officially, and BAC, as in this proposal, was to have 2/3 members of color and 1/3 of white. The second request was to establish a program to empower black communities through BAC, funded with $250,000 each for the next 4 years. And third, to make BAC a permanent entity, which would meet annually. A group of white supporters of BAC was soon formed. For full support, full recognition and funding of the Black Affairs Council. We're having fun back then. And the lobbying started. Discussions and arguments, passionate feelings on all time. The first meeting of full BAC and its steering committee with BAC and BAC representatives was actually held over the weekend of April 4th. The group was actually in session when King's assassination was announced. In the meantime, the UUA board continued its deliberations. It ignored Buck's proposal to abolish the Commission on Race and Religion, which Buck said was not relevant to black needs. The board decided that the commission had been ineffective due to underfunding, so it created a UU Commission for Action on Race, charged with administrating a new fund for racial justice now of $300,000. The Black UU Caucus and the Black Affairs Council, Buck and BAC, felt further ignored and increasingly frustrated. Feelings were increasingly heated within the larger UU membership too. A group called BAWA, Black and White Alternative, was organized. And its founder said that he regarded Buck and BAC as having shown their contempt and defiance of the most fundamental of democratic principles. He charged that Buck was a racially segregated organization. which represented the action of only a few individuals. Support for Fallback also grew. Its co-chair said, "Racism in America perpetuates injustice in the name of equality, exploitation in the name of impartiality, and segregation in the name of selectivity." In May of 1968, our UU General Assembly met. General Assembly is an annual gathering commonly called GA, and it lasts for several days and includes a variety of workshops and worship services and other events, and many hours of business meetings. At those meetings, the UUA board recommended funding to both BAC and BAWA, with the majority of funds going to BAC. But BAC and BUC leaders declared that funding BAWA undercut the leadership of Blacks, which BAC represented. And they announced that if BAWA was funded, BAC would refuse any funds. A vote was taken, and BAWA was not funded, the Black and White Alternative. Later, by a vote of 836 to 326, the General Assembly delegates voted to fund BAC, the Black Affairs Council, at the level for $250,000 for each of 4 years, with BAC administering those funds. The board seemed baffled by the vote and by how to implement it. To start with, our denominational bylaws stipulated that each affiliate member shall, in respect of its work, refrain from the practice of segregation based on race or color. So the board proposed a change to the bylaws to accommodate the special interest of race and color in order to ensure fuller participation in the larger society. The board granted affiliate status to BAWA, but it changed its name from Black and White Alternative to Black and White Action to de-emphasize the original purpose of providing an alternative to BAC. Despite these changes, conflicts and coalitions and controversies increased. Compounding the situation is that the reality that the UUA was in dire financial straits. You may or may not be aware that the UUA at this time was also in the process of publishing what we know now as the Pentagon Papers and faced all kinds of lawsuits over that. There were several major drains on funds. And the commitment of $1 million, or about $6.5 million today's dollars, was a lot of money. The board declared that the 4-year commitment would need to be reaffirmed at each subsequent GA, and it placed the funding issue on the agenda for the 1969 GA on the last day of GA, when many people would already have left for home. Heading into the 1969 General Assembly in Boston, feelings were running very high. One director of the UU's Service Committee said, "At its deepest level, it is a disagreement between a large and growing number of UUs who cannot contain their anxiety, anger, and frustration over the direction of the UUA and the country as a whole, and those other UUs who, although they may have an uneasy feeling that things are not what they should be, are still convinced that there is nothing inherently wrong that a little bit more talk or money or goodwill won't take care of." Immediately after the first business meeting of the 1969 GA, after the first business meeting at the 1969 GA was called to order, members of BUC and BAC moved that the agenda be reordered so that the vote on the funding came first. A two-thirds majority was required for such a change in the agenda, and the vote was 710 for and 536 against, with many abstentions. Clearly a majority, but not enough for the motion to carry. Representatives from BUC and the Continental Liberal Religious Youth Council at that point stood at each microphone, announcing that until the issues of funding were dealt with, they would not move. Speeches and pleas were made, passionate explanations given, and the meeting ended with no resolution. The next day, another motion was made to change the agenda, and another vote was taken. Again, it failed by 5 votes. And BUC members and BAC members and many of their supporters walked out of General Assembly. Over 400 people, or roughly a quarter of all attendees. They reassembled at the Arlington Street UU Church and have come to be called the Moral Caucus. Those remaining at General Assembly were stunned and angry and confused. A delegation was formed to meet with those who had left. Some, but not all of them, returned, and a vote was taken as to whether to fund Back or Bauer. The vote went to Back, 798-737, hardly overwhelming. The division within congregations and between friends and colleagues was deep and painful. Some of that still exists. In January of 1970, the board voted to cut Back's funding by $50,000 a year, ostensibly to spread the million-dollar commitment over 5 years instead of four, but the end was in sight. As a funded affiliate, Back could not raise funds for itself, nor could it meet the obligations it had pledged to those who had been awarded grants, so it relinquished affiliate status. 4 months later, the UUA board voted to terminate all funding for Back, and many of its programs had to close. I'm well aware of the implications when they closed the program in Oakland that was providing meals for school kids. Many of the other programs floundered, gradually faded. There was an effort to replace the lost UUA funds and continue programs, and Back began to sell capital investment back bonds to UU churches and individuals and others who wished to invest in Black-owned business and endeavors. Some organizations and churches within the UUA also donated money to try to keep those efforts going. Many members of Back left the denomination, and as Back and Buck fell away from the UUA, so did many of their supporters. Some members of Buck and Back attended the 1970 GA the next year, but there was no official presence. In 1972, some former Back members created the Black Humanist Fellowship, and that same year, the UUA received an unexpected sizable grant earmarked for Back, and they decided on their own to renew Back's affiliate status to give them money. Then there was disagreement over whether the Black Humanist Fellowship was a renamed Back or a separate religious group, and there was confusion over whether the Black Humanist Fellowship had a claim on the money. A lawsuit resulted, which is more than I'm going to begin to go into today. But the harm had already been done, leaving profound damage with deep and permanent scars. There were two men who were particularly important in the Back movement. One of them later went on to, was one of the creators of the series called Eyes on the Prize, and UUA did help to fund that. The other was a man who is now known as Entangolisi. When I was in seminary, I was a TA for the UU history class. And when we got to this part of our history, the professor said, you know, we have tried for years to get Entangolisi to come, but he is still sober and so angry that he won't. And to our surprise, about halfway through the class, he walked in. That would have been about probably 10 o'clock in the morning. And at 2 in the afternoon, he was still taking questions, and I don't think anybody had left even to go and get lunch or the bathroom. It was amazing. Starking also has held a conference a couple times for people who are on various sides of all of this. Starking is a seminary in Berkeley that I attended. And I think they've held two that I'm aware of, and both times there have been people who hadn't spoken since all of this and still find it difficult to be in the same room together. It was a very painful time. So what was the meaning of all of this? First of all, it's a reminder that we're not monolithic in our thought. We're not flawless in our actions. And we can flounder and fail with all the best of intentions. It's a cautionary tale reminding us that all hurts run deep. Many of those who left have never returned, or stayed away for decades before they would risk coming back. It certainly shows how difficult and complicated it is to address racism. It reminds us of how precious and fragile promises are, and how easy it is to make promises which we don't know for sure that we can keep, and what it costs when those promises are broken for whatever reason. Our best intentions are often not enough. One of the things that I'll talk about in 2 weeks is the fact that our board has again made financial promises. And one of the issues we're sitting with is, how can we fill those, and can we? In 2 weeks, we'll explore many aspects of how the UUA is trying to address racism now, in society at large and in our own denominations and churches. One of the things that we're paying a lot more attention to this time around is What's white privilege about? What's white superiority? What do we have to change in ourselves? What do we have to see, those of us who are white, which is the majority of the news, in order to affect real change? Our entire offering that Sunday will go to the efforts that UUA is making in this area, and I urge you to attend. Our UUA president from 2001 to 2009 was the Reverend Bill Sinkford, the first African-American elected to that post, and I'm proud to say a Star King graduate. He was very active in all of this Black Power things when he was in college, and he left feeling deeply hurt and very angry. Eventually, he did come back to the faith, attended seminary, and was ordained as a union minister. He serves now at our church in Portland, Oregon. I close with his words. Perhaps enough time has passed for those in my generation on both sides to forgive. Perhaps with growth in numbers and years of association and commitment to racism, we can begin to see ourselves with more diversity, if not in our pews, then in our RA programs among our children, thanks to interracial adoption, blended families, interracial marriages, and our kids inviting their friends of many races. Perhaps we are ready now to ask ourselves what kind of church we want for our children. We must learn to help all of our children to be proud to say, I am a Unitarian Universalist. This is my church. May we here now in 2018 be honest and brave enough to claim all of our history. May we learn from all of it, keep and celebrate what works, acknowledge where we blundered and learn from it, and then move forward, better informed and more humble, rededicating ourselves to this important, difficult, painful, and transformative work. Amen. It is our custom to have a time for you to respond to what's been spoken. In the interest of time and call, I think we'll do that right away. So, questions, comments?